Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. And this morning it is going to be a little bit different because we're going to be talking about earth power. Yes, the forces of nature, how they affect us, how we affect them. Yes, it's a full circle. You cannot live on this planet and not have actions or what might be considered inappropriate actions come back and affect us. We're a part of this thing expressed as nature. And so as the saying goes, what goes around comes around. And we're living in a time of change where things that we've done perhaps have created a negative result as far as Mother Nature is concerned. However, Mother Nature is not one to sit back quietly and just be. Oh no, she's always in a constant flux of change, and that is what we're going to be talking about today. High tide on Main Street. Yes, we had an experience just a short time ago, and my guest, John Englander, we're going to be talking about the rising sea levels and what he is perceiving as the coastal crises. And I think you'll find the information quite interesting. John Englander, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
John, you have had a very strong association with the Jacques Cousteau family. And the preface of this book was done by his son. And this is a family that Mr. Cousteau, he had such a vision. He had such a tremendous vision about life, about how we are all connected, and what we do makes a difference. Tell us your story about how you got involved with Jacques Cousteau and his family and became so concerned about what's going on.
Wow, that's a question I don't think I've ever been asked before, but I appreciate it. I got into scuba diving when I was a teenager. I'm now 62, and Jacques was already on TV with the specials, The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau, that some of us older folks remember as kind of one of few amazing specials. And I admired him, but I had a career in diving and met him once when I was a kid, and it was inspirational, but didn't really meet him again until 1997. I was running a group called Ocean Futures Society for the Diving Industry. I was on their the industry's board of directors. I had a big diving operation in the Bahamas, and we were trying to get divers concerned about the environment, and I brought Jacques over to an event in Orlando to help me raise some money. Well, out of that, make a long story short, he asked me to take over and run the Cousteau Society. He was 86 years old, and his family had kind of gone in different directions. There had been some divisions over the years for different reasons. So I spent several days with Jacques, and he did hire me to become CEO, but unfortunately, by the time I took the job, he was in the hospital and never got out. 3 months later, he was dead. So it was a very tumultuous time. But through that, I met the family, and I was there for the funeral in Notre Dame. But to make a long story short and bring it to your question, you know, it was interesting to look back with him in some private meetings there in January 1997, and look at what had changed in the world in his probably 70 years of working on environment and diving and the bigger environmental issues. And it just had a profound effect on me. And because I sold my business to do the job with him, it was a turning point. And since then, I thought back to those discussions and how climate has changed. And he and I spent some time. Back then, we had no idea how quickly the ice sheets would continue to melt and raise sea level. But again, to just shorten the story here, it's over the last 15 years, I guess, I've been growing in my awareness and concern, and I decided about 5 years ago that the story of sea level was an amazing lens through which to see the larger issue of climate, because sea level largely responds to the melting of the ice sheets. And we know what the old sea levels were. And I embarked, as you said before the interview in our conversation, I embarked on a five-year journey to research and explain what's going to happen to sea level and therefore the shoreline in the context of the history as opposed to just the projections. And what I found was amazing. And it does portend a whole new future for the planet.
I absolutely agree. And, of course, this planet is very, very old relative to our thinking processes and our areas of awareness with time. Now, I want my listeners to know that you're an oceanographer. You have explored the ocean globally. You are someone that really has a passion for marine science background, and you also have a background in geology and economics, which dovetails very beautifully with your research. And you have really taken on a very interesting positioning because, as I mentioned to you before we went on air, when I got your book, there's so many materials I've come across that will try to pigeonhole things with just one perspective. But you, in your book, High Tide, have brought in multiple levels of perception. You went back in history. You have researched so much. And Mother Earth goes through all kinds of shifts and changes. Now, what's intriguing is that there is this tremendous amount of activity that's going on. There is a warming up of the waters. We have had phenomenal volcanic activity that has occurred in the areas of the world, whether it's the Hawaiian Islands. We have had stuff going on in Alaska. We've got this phenomenal chain of activity that's going on. Well, this happens every so many hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years because they have found that in research. When you started this and you were looking at it, you found out about these cycles. What is the cycle in your research that we're in right now?
We have just entered a new cycle. Actually, what we've done is we've broken the natural cycle, and I can explain it pretty simply. And it wasn't clear to me until I started to write the book. In fact, as always happens when you go to teach something, you learn it better than ever. And I knew that sea level had been up and down. I knew that 100 million years ago, when there were dinosaurs, there was no ice on the planet, those steamy jungles, and even Alaska was about the temperature of Florida. I knew there was no ice then, and sea level was higher. What suddenly became clear as I put all the dates together of sea levels and temperatures and carbon dioxide levels that we know today from ancient records of locked in the ice cores and deep bone sediments, is that the ice ages, which we pretty well accept in the kids' movies and so on, but there's no doubt the ice ages have happened. We can see evidence of that very clear. We're about a 100,000-year cycle, and that's been going on for at least 3 or 4 million years. Between 95 and 125,000, so we'll just call it roughly 100,000 years, is the ice age cycle. The last ice age peak was 20,000 years ago. At that point, when there was 2 miles of ice, roughly, over the northern hemisphere, coming down over North America and Europe, sea level was down 390 feet, 120 meters below today. That's because of the amount of ice. And as that ice melted over 14,000 years, sea level rose 390 feet. To the present level. And it's been kind of where it is today for about 5,000 or 6,000 years, which is pretty much our recorded human history and our civilization, which is why we tend to believe it's permanent. But the truth is, sea level moves up and down almost 400 feet. It should be just starting the cycle phase of going down as temperatures cooled and ice sheets get bigger, but the opposite's happening. And when you look at the fact that the oceans are 0.8 degrees Celsius, a degree and a half Fahrenheit warmer than they were a century ago. And we know why. We can see it because of the heat trapped in the atmosphere from greenhouse gases. That what's happened is we've been in a tug of war, as I describe in the book, as you'll recall, that what's happening is the natural force was trying to cool things, according to what's called the Milankovitch cycle, which has to do with variations in solar energy. But we've been warming things. So like a tug of war, it's going back and forth. But now it's very clear that we are grossly overpowering the natural force. We are in a warming cycle when we should be in a cooling cycle. So in effect, we're not headed toward the next ice age, as would happen by the natural cycle of the last 3 or 4 million years. We will not, on the present path, have another ice age until the fossil fuels or the greenhouse gases in the air have been taken out either by man or by nature over millions of years. And so we're in a new, we've broken the natural cycle of ice ages, and we're entering a new phase when sea level will rise, the ice sheets will melt, and the shoreline will move inland. And by looking at geologic history, we can tell that that will happen for at least 1,000 years, even if we stop all fossil fuel burning tomorrow.
Last night, I was sitting with my husband, and we were watching a nature show done by David Attenberry. And it was the last of his three-part series. And it was fascinating to observe in this program how he had film footage from when he started his travels and started really getting involved with nature and the environment over 30 years ago. And he talked about so many areas on the planet that where there used to be tremendous amounts of forest, now that has all been cut away. He talked about different species being affected that have disappeared. And his concern is he saw the stuff affecting the ocean, and he said, here I am an older man in my older years, and in my lifetime I have watched this phenomenal shift. And he said, now it's time for us to be aware that we, and I'm using my own words, to really pay attention to what's going on. And because of people being interested and because of people wanting to make a difference and making a commitment to being good caretakers, custodians, whatever words you want to use, and being alert to what needs to be done, things are shifting, but they are shifting slowly. And he talked about the impact of population. He talked about a number of things that he has seen. Your book, High Tides, brings out that perspective. But you also talk about the natural phenomena that occurs. And again, it could be volcanic activity. That warms up the water so fast, it's unbelievable. I mean, volcanoes are powerhouses. And we have new land masses that are growing. The Hawaiian Islands, there's other parts underground where these land masses are developing. So we're seeing this shift, but we as human beings in many areas have decimated, I don't care what country you go to, we generally have decimated massive areas of forest, and the carbon dioxide plants just absolutely love. Trees love it. It's absolutely amazing, and so much has changed because of this, and I have seen areas where temperatures have gone up substantially because of population density and growth. When you were looking at this and when you're giving the information in your book, which is just excellent, what did your research discover relative to this?
Well, you've brought up a number of great subjects. The volcanism or volcanoes do heat the ocean, you're correct, but looked at in our scale of the century or so, that's probably not significant yet. Now, that could change if the volcanic activity changes, but in the times in the Earth's past, millions of years ago, when volcanism has had a dramatic effect on climate, not like in the last few centuries, what are called the flood basalts of the Pacific Northwest and other places in the world where there's thousands or hundreds of thousands of square miles of basalt that came out of molten out onto the earth. That changes climate big time. In our era today, things are changing quickly, and as you say, man's impact at 7 billion people headed to 9.5 billion people has to have an effect. And I just try and be a realist, and there's no point in wishing we'd go back to 3 billion people or that we'd all give up fossil fuels and cars tomorrow. That's not going to happen. So what I try and do is look at and say, what's inevitable? What's inevitable now is the shoreline's going to move inland. The forces are putting more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which does have an amazing change on the Earth's average temperature. It's hard to believe, but it's absolutely true, and it's easily provable. In fact, it was predicted back based on science in 1826. I mean, this isn't Al Gore or any new science. Carbon dioxide is a big heat-trapping gas, and just a concentration of another fraction of a percent has a huge impact on our average temperature. And we're used to a pretty temperate temperature regime. That's changing. We see that in vegetation patterns and rainfall patterns. And of course, it seems counterintuitive, but even in more snowfall in places, and I can explain that phenomenon if you like, because I know that disturbs people. How is it snowing more when we have our global warming? But to get back to your basic question, the forces of change really come down in our lifetimes or in human time scale of centuries or even a few thousand years even at the outside, to this industrialization, the changing the atmosphere. That's the fundamental thing. Now, there are natural cycles, again, that caused ice ages. The ice ages of the last 3 million years were there long before humans had any impact. In fact, long before humans existed on the Earth by our current science knowledge. So Earth has cycles. Ice ages are a prime example. The Earth's temperature has changed naturally over the last hundreds of millions of years, and we can now plot that. We can see evidence of that in the deep sea sediments. There are what we call proxies or isotopes that are actually very good ancient temperature gauges. But in the modern time, we have a great temperature gauge. When people say, I'm not too sure the Earth's warming, this is the proof, is the polar ice caps melting. Now, what surprises people is that even though they see photographs from satellites of the polar ice cap disappearing, and we, of course, firsthand stories now of people seeing the disappearing ice in Alaska and northern Canada and around the poles, that there is a natural cycle to it, but we've had a polar ice cap for 3 million years, and it'll be gone in September near as 2016 or as late as 2030. But sometime in the next two decades, the polar ice cap, the Arctic ice cap, will be gone, and they're talking about shipping goods across the North Pole and saving the passage time for ships to go through the Panama Canal, et cetera. But that we have to recognize that the melting of the polar ice cap proves the Earth is warming, warmer than it's been in millions of years. And what's surprising to people is most people think that that contributes to sea level rise. Because it's floating sea ice around the North Pole, it doesn't affect sea level. Sea level changes for three major reasons. One is just the warming. Like most substances, seawater expands just infinitesimally, but because the oceans are an average of 2 miles deep, as the ocean warms, it actually gets a little taller, and it's risen about 4 inches because of that in the last century. But then the rest of the rise comes from the melting of the glaciers and the two ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica. And again, it's contrary to popular impression, it's not the glaciers, even though it's sad to see them go, but even if we melt all the glaciers in the world, from Glacier National Park to Alaska to Peru to the Himalayas and the mountains in Europe, we'll only add 2 feet to sea level rise worldwide. The problem is what happens in Greenland and Antarctica. There's so much ice there, and it becomes obvious when you just look at a world map or Google Earth or anything. When Greenland melts entirely, it will raise sea level 24 feet worldwide. When Antarctica melts entirely, it'll raise sea level 185 feet. Now, that can happen for centuries and probably thousands of years. But this is the problem. Even if we raise sea level 10 feet this century, it's a disaster. Now, it's too late to stop it. We have to look at the Earth differently. We've had an impact. We're not going to go away. We're not going to stop burning fuels tomorrow. We should come up with new technologies. But we have to recognize that we have altered the pattern. There are natural patterns. But the simple reality is that after 6,000 years of stability, sea level is rising, and the shoreline is moving inland. And that's going to be the disruptive factor. That it's going to take us decades to get our heads around that.
I think it is a process of thinking that most individuals are not even going to be able to relate to. But I can remember when I was a little girl. We lived for a while, my family did, in Florida. And I remember how they were concerned about their shoreline in Florida because it was, in their words, at the time, eroding away. The water was coming in. So through the years, they've brought in sand, they've built barriers, they've done all kinds of things. But the reality is the shoreline in Florida, especially with a lot of the storms, it is disappearing. If they had not done what they did, we wouldn't even have certain areas of Florida available. It would all have gone underwater. So here we are at this time frame. We just had the recent Hurricane Sandy that I think really brought some very significant things to the forefront, and that is that people living in coastal areas, which has, as long as I can remember, always been considered prime property, they were at high risk. But the assumption was, gee whiz, don't worry about it, it's not going to affect us. And in previous generations, that may or may not have been the case, but in today's world, this is something, this particular happening, and you had theorized something along these lines when this book came out in 2012, that this could, you know, you could have a megastorm, which is what Sandy was, and flood the tunnels and everything else, and here it was. Bingo. This was a tremendous demonstration.
In fact, let me come back to timing because I know that you deal with some metaphysical or you know mystical issues on some of your programs for my bit of looking at your show recently preparing for this interview. And I want to come to that in just a minute. But back to the issue of Florida that you discussed in Sandy in general in terms of what the forces were, I think it's interesting to use it as an opportunity for all of us to step back and dissect it into a couple of pieces. Sandy was, of course, first and foremost a storm. Storms happen because of heat in the ocean, and as the oceans get warmer, we're going to have more intense storms, as has been happening. We can't predict where they're going to happen, and the patterns are changing as they warm. But that it was first and foremost a storm event. It happened to occur at high tide, and actually a full moon high tide, which added extra height to the ocean, which made it even worse.
Right.
But it was on top of slowly rising sea level, and that's the one that we have to step back and look at the big picture. Sea level is 8 inches higher than a century ago, but it will be anywhere from 3 to 10 feet higher by the end of this century. So that's the one that keeps raising slowly upward, which lifts everything else. The storm is on top of it. The high tide is on top of that, and an extreme high tide is on top of that. Erosion in Florida, it's important to clarify because everybody does bring them up when you talk about an event like Sandy, which does erode the shoreline. Erosion is a somewhat a natural event as the ocean does move the coastline over long periods of time. And kind of naively, we've built these big permanent buildings and seawalls and so on, assuming the beach would be there forever. But nature moves beaches over long periods of time. And we kind of ignored that when we built our big hotels and condos and all that on the beach in Florida. There's two kinds of erosion here going on, though. One is that eating away at the location of the shore on where it sits. And then there's, as the ocean rises globally, as the ice sheets melt, everything's going to just go, you know, that much more underwater. And that's a real problem for Florida because it's porous limestone. There's kind of, and I live in South Florida, there's a perception that, oh, well, as sea level rises, we'll build seawalls and keep the water out, and we'll have, just to pump the beaches back, to pump the sand in to keep the beaches where they are. But that doesn't recognize that Florida's got, and many coral islands in the Bahamas, Caribbean, and Pacific are made of porous limestone. It's not like the granite that Manhattan, New York City is on, where you could build a seawall and keep the water out. Here, even if you build a seawall, the ocean rises, it'll just percolate up through the ground in the middle of the city. It's like a sponge. It's like a hard sponge, and there's no way to block those billions of pores in the limestone. So Florida has a particular vulnerability. And then, of course, when storms come, they just, you know, pile water on top. But that's brief. What we need to start thinking about with Sandy is that Sandy was a storm event, and we can now repair that damage. But we need to realize that as sea level rises decade by decade by decade by decade, for as long as I could keep saying that, for 1,000 years, as sea level now has started this phase of rising, as it did 10,000 years ago, that it's a new reality, and that's not to recede. And it's silly to build back on the beach the way we did when we thought the beach was permanent. We now have to recognize that with the melting of the great ice sheets, Antarctica and Greenland, that sea level will rise for 1,000 years, and it will rise foot by foot by foot. It will rise at least 50 feet higher than it is today, and that could take thousands of years. But it's a new future, and we have to just stare that future in the face and deal with it.
There are already certain areas in the world that the rising sea levels are causing environments to disappear, islands to go underwater, and
sure.
land masses to go underwater. And all you have to do is sometimes just have a shift in the plates, and then you're going to have major things happening. But even without that, the rising sea levels have really posed a problem to certain environments on different parts of the planet because people will have to be relocated. And when you're dealing with masses of people, and you just think of what happened here in the U.S. with the effects of Hurricane Sandy, you had all these people in New Jersey and New York. If those people, let's say, had to be relocated to a new area, you have a big economic challenge. You have a challenge with sewage treatment centers. You have a challenge with the infrastructure that maybe is no longer going to be viable. You just know that these are things that have to be dealt with. And I'm intrigued in your book with how certain areas, certain people are thinking ahead. You talk about Galveston, Texas, and what they did after a particular thing that happened in the early part of the 19th century. You have all kinds of different positionings of, gee, what can we do here? Also, you bring out information about the acidity of the ocean. And this is something that I don't think many people know about, and the effect of that on the coral reefs throughout the world. And there's a couple of men that developed a pump to affect a certain coral reef in the world, trying to keep it healthy by monitoring the temperature of the water. Tell us about that.
Oh, sure. That's Brian Von Herzen and Phil Kittle. Came up with a clever system where they could bring cooler, deeper water up from the ocean and actually using a simple mechanical pump that's just driven by wave energy and just kind of, with flapper valves, lift water up from deeper water, which has an effect of cooling the corals, which can rejuvenate them and save them. And that's a fascinating technology because it doesn't use external energy sources. But the ocean acidification, which also affects corals is a slightly different aspect than temperature. Just to clarify that for your listeners, that ocean acidification also comes from putting too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which traps heat and raises temperature. But the other thing it does is it dissolves into the ocean gradually over years. And just like carbon dioxide bubbles in a soda bottle, when it's under pressure, we can't see them. It's dissolved in the liquid until you remove the cap. Well, because of the air pressure above, there's a certain amount of carbon dioxide dissolves in the ocean. And carbon dioxide, like the acidic taste we get from a club soda or a Perrier or seltzer, we know that that's a little bit acid. And what's happening is, as carbon dioxide dissolves in the ocean over the last 30 years, it has increased the acidity of the ocean by 30%. The pH we think about when we plant roses or other kinds of plants, what the soil acidity is, plants need a certain acidity, and what's happening in the ocean is that the oceans are becoming more acid, or actually technically less alkaline. And as that happens, not only are the corals being stressed, but probably of greater concern to people in the ocean food chain is that all the mollusks, the shellfish, the mussels and clams and that kind of life of the ocean that we use for food and as part of the food chain, those shells are not able to form as the alkalinity decreases or as the oceans become more acid. And that's already posed a problem. In the Pacific Northwest, in the last 2 or 3 years, they've had a failure of the baby or larval or spat for the oysters and clams that are raised as a huge billion-dollar industry up there. And it's just the harbinger of things to come, that there's no way to really change that if, given this carbon dioxide that's dissolving the ocean again, besides raising the heat of the planet, as it just slightly changes the ocean acidity, we probably won't have shellfish in the next few decades. And it'll change from different places because the amount of carbon dioxide that dissolves depends upon temperature and currents to some degree. So there may be some areas where we can still grow shellfish, either naturally or in aquaculture for a while. But that should be a profound concern, as well as the coral reef injuries. So it's just an example, and I'm glad you brought it up, that there are things that come from this extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that people wouldn't bother to think about usually. And ocean acidification as the CO2 dissolves in seawater is a profound effect. And in fact, it's probably one of the most profound effects of this extra CO2.
John Englander, your book, High Tide on Main Street, is, I think, a fascinating read. I think it is a book that educates, informs, gives perspectives regarding how we can prepare our future generations, how we need to educate our children, how we need to be aware of what is evolving, and how, as people, we've come up with innovations in the past that have made shifts and changes that were positive, and we need to do that even now. And I really think that your book goes a long way to opening up an understanding, not just about chemistry and about the way historically the natural forces have flowed, but also to wake us up to realize that we are having an impact. We can do things to make a difference, but we have to educate ourselves and perhaps even become politically involved, understanding that it is important to speak up, speak out, and to take action. Your book, High Tide on Main Street, Rising Sea Level and the Coming Coastal Crisis, is a fascinating publication. Go to johnenglander.net. That's John ENGLANDER.net, and you'll find a great deal of information there that will give you some insights. But the book itself really makes a good read, and I'd say use a highlighter when you're reading it so that you can go back and reference different points of detail so that you can question, you can examine, you can look at what is really happening. And will it affect you? Well, only time will tell. It's affecting us right now, but we're looking at not just now, for the future, for those that will follow us. John Englander, thank you so much for being with me today. It has been a delight having you as a guest. Again, the website is johnenglander.net. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I'm delighted that you've been able to join me today, and I'm available if you would like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, I will give you my insights, and you're welcome to ask me a question about anything you like. Quickly, I want to bring up the fact, I know you've just heard the Northwest Women's Show ad. By golly, I'm looking forward to this event. It is coming up in just a few days, March 1, 2, and 3. And on March the 1st, I'm going to be presenting a forum for the ladies attending. I've got six dynamic Pacific Northwest speakers, eclectic subject matter. It's just going to be absolutely wonderful. And that information is being published on the Northwest Women's Show website, so you'll have all of that there. And also, I wanted to say, come on by booth number 405, because I'm going to be there. We just have a wonderful time interacting with people, and it's always nice to meet you. I'll be doing mini sessions as well as having a plethora of book publications that I really think you will enjoy. So you'll have a chance to peruse through those as well. So do keep that on your calendar. Ladies, it is an event you don't want to miss. Almost everything imaginable for women is there. Food, fun, entertainment. Ah, yes, we even have the dancing firemen. Oh, it's just so much fun. You will enjoy it immensely. So put it on your calendar. Make it a weekend of fun. Check in with your friends. You'll really enjoy it. That's the Northwest Women's Show. Check it out, and I hope you'll stop by and say hello. Donna Sebo here, and I wanted to mention that John Englander's book, he told me that it's also available in ebook and audiobook. So go to his website, johnenglander.net, and check out the information, because the different applications for the book High Tide on Main Street will be there available for you. I started off sharing a story with you about an event that occurred in, I don't know about you, but I love the oddball stuff. So many times we get into our linear modalities and we forget that Mother Nature is not always going to meet our criteria. How many times has that happened? Well, I don't think we'd ever be able to add up all those times. Regardless, this was a particular event, and it was in 1869. It occurred in Tennessee during the month of August. It was described as a superheated cyclone, and the visual of this is just amazing. Now, they apparently clocked it. Now, it wasn't traveling all that fast. It was only going at 5 miles per hour. It went through a countryside in Tennessee, totally destroying the farmhouse of a family. The man that owned it, his name was Ed Sharp. Now, what happened is as it passed over the building, this superheated cyclone, it ignited the shingles and covered the house in a cloak of fire in just minutes. I mean, that's a given. That happens very, very fast, especially with wood shingles. Now, it was consuming anything burnable, dry leaves, twigs. It became a wind tunnel, literally, a moving wind tunnel of combustion. It was fire in movement. And it grew bigger and bigger and bigger. And every time something was burned, it increased in volume and in temperature. There were two horses where this fire went over them. Their manes and tails were burned to the flesh. And, of course, the animals, I'm assuming they may have had to put them down. I don't know. But it was quite a trauma for them. And they called it a demon whirlwind. It went through a wheat field. Haystacks were burned. Now, there was a forest that was in its path. It incinerated green leaves to ashes and left the trees to smolder and burn slowly over time. The path of destruction was 20 feet wide. When the whirlwind reached a river, it turned downstream, and a pillar of water shot up into the air about a half a mile. 200 people saw all of this occurring. And then, all of a sudden, it disappeared. Fascinating phenomena. Is it replicatable? I don't know. Maybe there's some lab in the world that could replicate it. But when you have these unique things occur, it really is intriguing, and it makes you wonder, what else can happen in life that is totally unpredictable? No guarantees, but the unique and the unusual will always fascinate us on one level or another. Donna Sebo here, and give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. All I need is your first name or initial, and then after that, well, just sit back and relax, and I'll tell you what I perceive. And, of course, you can always ask a question about whatever you like. I wanted to share a quick recipe for you. If you're like me and you've become more aware that you really want to be attentive to how well you take care of your body, and this is something health, it's just like anything else. We have to be good custodians for ourselves. Well, I like potatoes, and I like sweet potatoes. And sweet potatoes, you can bake them. I don't care. They're good, they're delicious, and they're very good for you. But there are those members of family that just absolutely love fries. So how can you fix some sweet potato fries that are going to have all of this nutritional value, taste good, and yet not have a lot of excess calories to it? Well, Rocco de Spiritos has a recipe, and I came across this, and I thought, okay, this sounds really good, and it is good. So let me share it with you. What you're going to need is 2 medium sweet potatoes. Now, by the way, per serving, typically, when you fix sweet potato fries, oh, they are so good. Usually, it's about, for an average serving, it's about 500 calories, lots and lots of fat in it. But this version, you're going to go all the way down to 58 calories. You think it's worth trying? Mm-hmm. You can have your potato, eat it too, and it tastes good. So let me give you the recipe. 2 medium sweet potatoes. You're going to need salt, nonstick cooking spray, or just plain olive oil. It's very good with this. And you can take a tablespoon or two of it if you want. I'd recommend a tablespoon. 2 tablespoons of fresh thyme leaves, freshly ground pepper, sweet paprika, and some cayenne pepper. Uh-huh, yeah, this is going to have sweetness and bite to it. Now, this is what you do. You're going to cut your potatoes lengthwise into about a quarter-inch thick slices, and you then want to cut those slices into about a quarter-inch wide sticks. You want to put them in a large bowl and sprinkle it with salt and let it stand for about 20 minutes. Now, we all know that salt will absorb moisture, and that's what you're wanting to do here. Now, in the meantime, while this process is going on, you want to preheat your oven to 450 degrees. And you want to put a rack on the baking sheet that you're going to use. You want to spread your potatoes out on paper towels to absorb any excess moisture. Transfer those dried potatoes, slices, you want to transfer them to a big bowl, and you want to coat it with, you can use your nonstick cooking spray if you want, or just take a tablespoon of olive oil and sprinkle it and then just toss it. And then you also want to take your thyme, your sweet paprika, and your cayenne pepper, and you want to figure out what amount is going to really work with your taste buds. And you want to mix those together, and then you want to sprinkle those potatoes that have been covered with oil out. Sprinkle them with your seasoning and spices. Then you want to take the potatoes and spread them out on a baking sheet on that rack, and you want to bake them until they're golden and tender. It's going to take about 20 to 35 minutes, dependent on the thickness of the slices. So you might want to set your timer for about 20 minutes and then just check them and see what they're like. Go in and maybe sample one. Yeah, that's a good excuse to sample, to see if they are done and if they're as crispy as you want them to be. So this is a simple recipe. And, of course, you can double it or triple it and have fun experimenting with spices. Maybe you don't like cayenne. Maybe you want to use something else. Cooking is something you need to have fun with. And if you have kids, maybe all you want to use on this is salt and pepper. And maybe you want to have them tell you, gee whiz, I'd like to try this spice or that spice or the other spice. It's fun to experiment with a recipe like this because it's so simple, it's so basic, and you can adapt it in different ways. But more than anything else, you're going to find that nutritionally, it's not just going to taste good, but it's going to be good for you. Donna Sebo here. We're going to be taking a break for a minute. Don't go away. We've got more good things to share. And, of course, you can always give me a buzz if you like, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Northwest Women's Show, Friday through Sunday, March 1st through 3rd at Seattle's CenturyLink Event Center, where you'll find 3 days packed with fashion, fitness, food, and fun. Each day features life-changing seminars and, of course, shopping, shopping, shopping. Meet smooth crooner Philip Lomax from The X Factor. Enjoy live music from country music star Jared Neiman and others. Learn what the numbers can tell you about your future, from numerologist to the stars, Glynis McCants, and get a peek at how the Ice Chip Grannies successfully navigated ABC's hit show, The Shark Tank. JCPenney will give you a heads up on trends for spring with fashion shows, and everyone loves those smoking hot firefighters. The Northwest Women's Show, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, March 1st through 3rd, sponsored by Snoqualmie Casino, Safeway, and BECU. Show schedules and ticket information at nwwomenshow.com. Sponsored by Snoqualmie Casino, Safeway, AARP, and BECU.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Open phone lines, 888-627-6008. And I wanted to share something with you. I'm so glad we have finally dispelled the myth that as people get older, they're supposed to get dumber. The little gray cells just aren't working. I love that quote from Hercule Poirot. I love his little gray cells image. The reality is that intelligence can continue to expand. You can do that for yourself. And I find it so much fun because of the tremendous amount of reading that I do. Subject matter, everything from the rising tides to metaphysical things to medical science, all kinds of areas that I have the privilege of reviewing. And I know so many people will say, oh, I just don't want to do this. I just don't have the time for this. But they'll sit in front of a television, and I'm sure all of us are guilty of this at one time or another, and they'll spend hours watching information that somebody else is dictating to them without questioning it. And I think learning is something we always need to be open to. And I came across some information that was quite interesting about how many women in their 40s, 50s, and 60s are going back to school. And this is something that is expanding their thinking, and they are realizing they have to develop careers. I was talking with some men not too long ago who were saying, I never dreamed that in my 70s and my 80s, I would be developing a new business. I would be developing a different learning curve and or their teaching. Now, this goes between both sexes. I think we are not just having a major shift on the earth itself, but it's a shift in perception. It is an understanding that we must be active participants in life. And I can remember my grandfather telling me how when he was working, and he was born right at in 1900, and he would be 113 years old today if he had lived. Well, by golly, here he was when he was 55 years old, they threw him out of work because men normally in the 50s didn't live past their 50s. So when you take a look at that paradigm and you look at where we are today, because of medical care, because of food, because of more sanitary conditions in life, there is and medical understanding, all kinds of things, men and women are living a lot longer. So now we have a modality where it's, you've got a longer lifespan, what are you going to do with it? How do you choose to live your life? We've gone through modality shifts where, gee whiz, what I thought I was going to be able to have for retirement, people that have gone through that planning, I know I've talked to some just in the past couple of weeks. They said, we can't live on that. That's not going to work because of inflation. When you look at all of these shifts and changes that have occurred within, I'd say, less than 50 years, and with the advancement of technology, we are having to change our minds. We are having to expand our understanding of life. Now, I've known people that have said, I don't want to be educated. I don't want anything to change. I'm not going to do anything. But that's not wise, because you then are going to end up perhaps having a victim mentality or not being able to really participate in life with a sense of purpose. You're going to find yourself feeling like you're subjugated to environments of political attitude, action, that you don't really want to support. So it's important for us to keep ourselves mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically alive, active, and involved. Now, one of the best ways to really activate the brain is with conversation. I'm telling you, it really is amazing. You get a group of people together of diverse backgrounds. They start telling their stories. And before you know it, you're learning things that you had no idea had evolved. You didn't. You couldn't possibly. But their life pattern, their life stories, were engaged in an entirely different modality from yours. And so when you interact in conversation, when you are communicating, when you read diverse pieces of material, when you open yourself up to things, you're going to find your world expands. You're going to become more of a problem solver, not just someone that sits back and whines about how life stinks. Instead, you're going to become more proactive. Maybe you'll change certain habits that you have in your own life so that you feel better, you are more effective, and you feel like you're contributing to life. Maybe you go out and plant 100 trees. Because you want to contribute to the wellness of the planet. I mean, there's no end to what you can do. But these conversations are so important. Brainstorming with people. And you know what I think is cool is if you can get somebody from their 80s or 90s, and I'm not joking here, and get teenagers involved. Let's get a communication circle here. You get all kinds of ideas. But what's good is that the generations are communicating. There's a tradition that I was introduced to. I'd heard it, but it was a meeting of grandmothers. This is a group that was formed by a woman in California where she felt women needed to have an opportunity to communicate, and they used a talking stick. And that talking stick is passed from one person to another. Nobody is allowed to talk other than the person with the talking stick. I loved it. And what was so wonderful is that there was this sense of trust and communication, and every single woman in this circle was able to share from her inner space, her emotional, her heart space, with those around. And you know what happened afterwards? Some of the women were experiencing certain challenges. After the talking stick was passed, there was this wonderful openness of communication. Here, let me help you with this. Here, I know about that. This is what we can do. It was marvelous, and that's what we need to remember. So it's something, conversation, interaction, have neighbors over, talk to people. Oh, I know you're going to always end up with some little snit somewhere that just is going to have their attitudes, but that's a blessing too. Because a lot of times we have attitudes and take directions because we're scared, because we're afraid of the unknown. And just like our book, High Tide on Main Street. Now, someone might read it and go, just, oh my goodness, their mind might go off in a tailspin, and they're thinking, oh, it's the end of the world. No, 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 it's not the end of the world. And what John Englander was trying to say is, let's be awake. Let's know that what was happening here is something that we can do something about. We may not be able to affect everything, but we need to be consciously present with what is going on. And remember, one person can really make a difference in this world. And that person could be you. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Won't you join me tomorrow? We've got a great guest, and we're going to be talking about your ultimate life plan. I hope you can join me. I always enjoy your company. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.